I think there is definitely a fine line of being able to balance what is too much to ask, and I don't think it's to me it's never considered spoiling a child to want to do things for your child. I think that's very much a natural thing, and even for me as a teacher, it's a natural thing to want to help them and just do everything for them because in my eyes they are my babies as well.
This is a Baby Brunch podcast. Epimax Baby and Junior's range is excited to announce the newest addition. The new Epimax sunscreen lotion offers broad-spectrum protection for all skin types, including your baby's delicate skin. Enriched with vitamin E, aloe vera, and bisoblol, the moisturizing SPF 50 lotion is dermatologically approved and provides daily defense against harmful UVA and UVB rays. Try it today and experience the difference. Available at all leading pharmacies countrywide. Welcome to another Baby Brunch podcast. We knew that you would want to know about school readiness. So we found you the best teacher in South Africa. She resides in Paarl, and we actually found her on social media. She has the cutest videos ever. When we log on, we see how she teaches her class. I'm talking about Being the Foundation. That's how you find her on Instagram. She is a foundation phase teacher. She teaches ages 5 to 9. I think the cutest interaction happens with her foundation phase, the 5-year-olds. Take a listen to this, and even take a look of this if you're listening to and watching on our video platform, to teacher Emily Dearham in action in her classroom. Emily, at age 25, you are a qualified foundation phase teacher, and you've got your degree, and you make the most beautiful videos in your class. What motivated you to take to social media with Being the Foundation, with these cute videos of these adorable children?
Well, thank you so much. Wow. So I started social media in my second year of studying, actually, and my idea with it was the reality of being a student during COVID, and I just happened to be a foundation phase teacher, teaching student at the time. So that's kind of where I started. But now, as I've grown, the idea is to share activities and ideas with parents and teachers all over the world, and more specifically for South Africans, to give our citizens, fellow citizens of South Africa, some insight into what happens in a foundation phase classroom.
I must say, you make teaching look like a lot of fun, and I see how you interact with the little ones. And I think this is what brings us to school readiness. We thought to ourselves, instead of just watching your cute videos online, we really want to be ready for grade one for next year. Most of us on this platform, and some of us new to school, are either very afraid of grade one. Some of us are unsure because we don't know what to expect. Others call it big school. You've had groot school. We're not sure what to see in big school. What is school readiness, and what is it about? Why do they call it school readiness?
So school readiness, if we can actually just take it as it is, it's being ready for school. But there's actually so many aspects of what it means to be ready for school, in terms of there's just so many aspects to cover. But basically, have they developed enough to go to school and thrive and reach their full potential? So it is very important for a child to be school ready. Mm-hmm. And there are many steps that you can take to ensure that they are ready to go to grade one.
What are some of the key academic skills that you look out for? So let's say a child is in your school, marking them in that first term. What are you looking out for?
Well, we look out for things very holistically in foundation phase. So that means that we are actually looking at more than just academics. So it's not necessarily just about if they can read and write and how far have they come with their counting skills. It is also about, are they socializing? Are they emotionally stable? Are they be able to regulate themselves? Are they regulating themselves during conflict situations or situations where they might feel unsure of themselves. So we are always constantly observing that. When we do look at the academics, the first thing that we'd like to see is just really their baseline of, can they count? How far can they count? Can they write their name? Are they able to hold a pencil correctly? Do they know how to use the scissors without cutting themselves or their clothing?
Aww.
We look at all those very basic things. We look at things that their social interactions come with a lot of their home language. So that falls under home language, actually. Where are they talking to the teacher? Are they communicating with friends? Are they able to communicate their needs? Do they follow instructions? There's a wide range of things that we actually do look at. It's not necessarily always very, very important for them to do things perfectly or have to have mastered certain skills at the very beginning of grade one, because that is why they have come to school. And that's why we call it a baseline, so that we as teachers can see, okay, this is where I need to start, and they know at least something and we can work with that.
There's a really big worry to parents, you know, because now you kind of want to at home let them develop some of the skills. Is that advisable? I mean, I'll tell you a little secret. I have had two babies in grade one, and my one is, I've actually had four babies in grade one, but the last one is grade one now. And I in grade R, I had her start reading. So, look, it's benefited us this year in grade one. Do we do that? Do we like add skills and, you know, help them to land in grade one better? Is that advisable?
I would say so, yes. We see that a lot where parents have already started helping with the development, and development actually does start at home. So as a teacher, that makes me very happy to hear, because it actually makes our job just that tiny bit easier. And we always appreciate when parents are so hands-on and interested in their child's education and their learning. So that is definitely something I would encourage. It doesn't necessarily have to be reading per se, but even just telling their own stories or anything basically that will build their self-esteem. Running around it sounds so like, oh, running around, what would that do? But we're actually working a lot of their muscles that they end up needing to be able to sit at a desk and write. So if you as a parent are playing with your child, it doesn't necessarily always have to be this educational sit-down play. It can literally be just spending time with them and asking them some questions about what are they playing and why, and just encouraging them to talk a little bit more about their own thoughts.
I love that they can that playing can be learning, you know, the at home play or building a puzzle. Are there certain daily routines that we need to establish before grade one? I remember in grade one with my last two now, they get a little pamphlet, and then on the little pamphlet it shows what to pack in your school bag. So you always need to remember your dress, your socks. There's also one for the lunchbox. You know, what do there must be water, a fruit, and so no. There's we learn with pictures, but in terms of daily routines, is there something that we need to master before they go to school? Before we hand them to you, like, ah, here's our babies. What should we be able to master at home before grade one?
That is a very important thing, to be able to pack a bag, actually. We often find some children come to school, come to grade one, and then they haven't fostered that independence yet to be able to pack a bag themselves. And while that is never an issue for the teacher to help, it does save us a lot of time if we don't have to pack everybody's bags. I mean, sometimes we are sitting with about 35 to 40 kids in the class. That's a lot of bags to pack. So just being able to do simple things like packing away your things after playing with them at home really helps us in the classroom, because if they are using pencils or whatever it may be in the classroom, even toys, puzzles, to know that once we have finished playing with it, it needs to be packed away. That is something that is actually a skill that we need them to be able to do things independently, because there are so many children, we can't unfortunately give them that individual attention of, okay, let's pack it away together. They need to be able to do it for themselves.
Let's talk independence. How important is it to have independence and self-care abilities in grade one? I mean, they are so small. Some of them are 5 turning 6, others are 6 turning 7. Teacher Emily, aren't we expecting too much from them?
It really does feel that way sometimes. I even feel really guilty sometimes when you kind of have to give a little bit of tough love in terms of independence and being able to do things for themselves. But unfortunately, it is necessary. It's not only saving time for the teacher, but some of the things are actually safeguarding, such as going to the bathroom and being able to clean themselves properly, remembering to wash their hands. Unfortunately, teachers are not allowed to go into the bathroom with a child, as it is a safeguarding risk. So we do need them to be able to have that independence of going to the bathroom by themselves, knowing when they need to go to the bathroom is a big one as well. It's because they are so small. They do still have accidents. They don't always have the self-confidence to come tell the teacher, especially in the beginning of the year, I need to go to the bathroom, or where is the bathroom? Mm-hmm. They have a little bit of, like, I suppose some anxiety around it. It's a new environment as well. So that is why part of our routine as we start school is to show them where the bathroom is and remember to wash your hands and all of that. But not only that, of course, now the next step would obviously be to wash your hands, and that would be to safeguard ourselves as teachers, them as learners of, you know, hygiene, washing our hands, keeping safe from germs. And they would have to do that all independently, because when one child has left the classroom to go to the bathroom, for example, I unfortunately can't leave the rest of my kids to their own devices in the class. They might just break everything down. So they have to be able to do that independently. And again, within the classroom, when we are doing a worksheet, or when I'm busy on the carpet with a smaller group, for instance, the rest of the class need to be able to work independently on what we have just done, or the worksheet or a task that I have given them. It's really important for them to do that independently, because I can't sit next to all of them all the time, unfortunately.
How do we nurture that at home? I mean, that notion of independence. You know, at home, you want to do everything for themselves. I'm thinking of my kids who are even a little bit older. You know, if they ask for a glass of water, it's not always where I'll go pour it yourself. Sometimes you want to actually just serve it to them and make it easier for them. Or, oh, school must have been so hard, let them relax. You know, sure, I do spoil the kids. But I mean, how much of these independent tasks do they need to have at home? And how do we know it's age appropriate? Like, you can't ask your 6-year-old to start making their beds. Or maybe you can. I'm not sure.
I think there is definitely a fine line of being able to balance what is too much to ask. And I don't think it's never considered spoiling a child to want to do things for your child. I think that's very much a natural thing. And even for me as a teacher, it's a natural thing to want to help them and just do everything for them, because in my eyes, they are my babies as well. So it really is difficult to balance that. But it is just important to keep it in mind that certain things, just as a practice type of thing, to do it independently. So I think just finding that balance of when can they pour themselves water and when can mommy do it for you. There's really not a problem with either one. I think fostering independence isn't necessarily having them do activities all by themselves. So if you are busy cooking supper and they really want to help, of course they need supervision in the kitchen, but that does foster independence, because it allows them to explore something new, and they are having guidance from an adult to then maybe in the future be able to do it by themselves. So there are steps to it. And in the beginning of grade one, we do, I mean, sometimes the older grade teachers are like, by the time they come to us, they're so used to being spoon-fed. But it just is that way. You just do spoon-feed them. You just do guide them along, and it does foster independence. But I think fostering independence at home, if you really would like a actual task for them to sit and do, would be for them to sit alone and build a puzzle, for example, or for them to sit alone and color in a piece of paper, or try and write their name, or anything like that. Even if it is just 5 minutes at a time, they say a child's attention span is only as long as their age is. So if they are only 6 years old, they can only really sit for 6 minutes and concentrate. And those little tasks all eventually add up.
What activities can we do at home for fine motor? Is this still a thing? I mean, you know, when it comes to and earlier we talked about them running around in lockdown and all these other interesting times in our country, you know, we would push for jungle gyms more, and it was almost, well, that component was wonderful because gross motor, we worked more on that. But in terms of fine motor at this age, is it still important for them? And what can we do at home?
Yes, so fine motor skills and just motor skills in general at between the ages of 5 and 9 are really when they're actually developing the most and when we can see the most rapid development happening. So as much as we do focus on the gross motor skills, we also focus on the fine motor skills because it does allow them to have an easier time reading and writing. And funny enough, people look at it, they say reading for fine motor skills, and it very much it plays a role with one another. It's all the muscles, even the eyes, with the muscles in the eyes, they work together as that. So oftentimes when we do fine motor skills, we are actually practicing the eye muscles as well. So that does fall into that category as well. So I like to use household items, especially when I'm talking to the parents in my class, make it really relevant and easy for them to do at home, because some parents don't always have access to all the brand new resources that you can get at P&A, for example. So one thing you can do is homemade Play-Doh. You can, even if you have a little bit of sand outside, digging in the sand, that's fine motor skills. I mean, they're gripping onto the spade and moving it in and out. So you're actually doing fine motor and gross motor at the same time. Building puzzles, if you have puzzles at home, if you are comfortable enough with your child using possibly a child-friendly knife to cut up a fruit or something like that, that movement is very important. Using scissors, even if you are sitting there having a fright because you feel like they're about to cut themselves, let them try and do it, but explain to them, don't cut yourself. Look, if you hold the scissors like this, you might nick your finger. But really let them do it, even if they're just busy cutting up pieces of paper with no purpose, really. Just let them do it. If you want them to make patterns in some salt, if you lay salt down on a plate, let them make some patterns in the salt with their fingers. That's also a really good one for fine motor skills. They do use it every day naturally.
I'm all of a sudden thinking of I would do activities with them against glass and let them paint against glass. We also een keer onself lelik vasgeloop. We did a glass paint session the one day my husband wasn't very happy, and I didn't realize that it's acrylic paint, and they painted the bathroom window, and then when it came to time to wash it off, obviously it didn't want to wash off and it wasn't very good. But now at least we have a beautifully stained glass window, and they're already much older and the window still looks like someone painted it from 5 years ago. How important is it for our child to write their own name before grade one? You know, I had such a laugh the other day. My dad actually brought it up where he said, you know, is it still like that? He wanted to know from me, you know, having access to all these experts with Baby Brunch, where a child needs to write their name before grade one. And I said to him, I actually don't know if it's a thing, but it seems like most of them can do it already. Do they get judged whether they can write their name or not?
That is actually expectation from grade R already. So okay. I say expectation very lightly because I don't want parents to be maybe have a misconception there, or they need to write it perfectly. It's not really about that. It's really about being able to identify their work without us having to write every single one's name. And then it gives them the sense of like belonging and just the sense of I know how to do something when I go to school, which is very important as well. And I belong in this class because I can write my name and I can show the teacher that I belong here. It really gives them that sense of like accomplishment, and this is my work, being very proud of their work. Me, myself, I speak for myself only. You do get used to and accustomed to how certain learners will write their name. So it might not be perfect, but I know exactly whose name that is. But again, it is just about, it obviously increases the fine motor skills. It's just the starting point of being able to develop. But again, when I say an expectation in grade R, it's just kind of the gist of the name. And then in grade one, I wouldn't say necessarily in the baseline of when we first get to school, but at least as long as it's like an identifiable scribble of something that makes it look like a name, that's more or less what we're looking for in the very beginning of grade one. And then by the end of grade one, we do expect them to have developed enough to write that with ease.
Now, my children have a love for reading, and I must say it's not my doing. It is totally my husband. He's a bookworm. He's a bookworm, and what he has done from a very young age is to nurture reading, with all four of the kids, and they love books. They love. I have one of my kids. She will cry before bedtime because she wants to read another page and another page. And I saw this recently now with my grade three, that often parents get into a predicament where they need to now do unprepared reading in the class, and they are scrambling for books or which books to, excuse me, to give their children to read because it's not something that they love or that they've become accustomed to at home. How do we encourage children to love books? I mean, I don't know if my strategy will work for everyone. In fact, I can assure you that my strategy won't work for everyone, but how do we get children to love reading?
That is a very difficult one. It's very much a preference, actually, from person to person, in my opinion. Scientifically, there isn't really a way to force someone to love to read. You'll just find that some children will love to do maths and numbers, and some children will just really love to read. And like you mentioned now with your husband, if he is a bookworm and they are seeing that he's leading by example, so they've just naturally had books access to them and they've seen their parents read their books, and so that's like, oh, okay, that's something I'd like to do because I'd like to be like daddy or I'd like to be like mommy. I do work at a school where unfortunately books are not always readily available because they can be quite expensive. So I do have books within the classroom. And some children absolutely love the books, will read books all day, and then there's other children who are really just not interested at all. So I think what you can do to try and foster the love is really make it very exciting. So what I do for my children who really don't like reading, they're not too interested in the phonics even, is to bring in puppets and to just make it super exciting that there's just this excitement around, okay, I want to do this again now because that was so much fun. Which you can do at home even as well. Just take a sock and put some googly eyes on there and off you go. So that is definitely something that you can try. And then, of course, how you want to start in the very beginning of grade one and even in grade R is having, you don't necessarily as a parent have to read the story. You can have them look at the pictures and tell their own story. So that kind of gives them this love for, I like to tell stories, and you as a parent can sit there and be like, oh my goodness, and what happened next? And really encourage them to talk about the story and make it seem like this is the best story that you have ever heard. My kids have started doing that in my class now, and now they start writing their own books, they're folding papers, and that just is fostering this love for reading. And because they're seeing, oh, but this child is getting praised for making a book or for reading a book or telling me a story, I want to do that. So now I'm going to get involved. So they do learn from each other as well.
I love the storytelling idea and creating a story so that a mom can tell them or dad can tell them or whoever can tell them that this is the best story that they've ever heard. There's also a lot of for those of you that have access to this, I remember one of the gifts that one of my kids got as a birthday gift was there were a few cards and you could probably draw them or just take a magazine and cut out pictures and then tell them to tell you a story and to make up the story. It became good fun in our home telling these stories from just pictures, you know, because at that age they don't read all these big words. Do we introduce, you know, I'm thinking of with my first one, you realize they're going to school and all of a sudden everything must be counted, you know, oh, let's take the chicken out. One, two, three, you know, eventually they're like, can you please stop? You know, everything doesn't have to be school. Like, how engaged must we be? Must we show them that everything, is related to school? Is it that important? Do we introduce maths concepts at home in an engaging way, or do we leave it for the teacher?
I think, again, there is definitely a fine balance between that. And now, because from grade one, they will also start getting homework. So they are already bringing school home with them. So from grade one, I wouldn't say it's really of utmost necessity to always be counting and to always be engaging and to always be asking, what color is this? What sound does this start with? I think they just need a break sometimes. They just also need to play and relax and just realize that that real life also does carry on without having everything being related to school. I think if they are interested to know, what does this word start with, or how can I break this word up, or how many pieces of chicken are there in this pack, then of course encourage it, count it with them. But only if they are really showing interest in that. I think there is just time and place for all of that. I would say if you have a child who is maybe even pre-grade R, who hasn't gone to grade R yet, then maybe there are some instances where you can do a bit more counting because they are still getting used to it. But I think most children, by the time they get to grade one, can count to 10 quite easily. So it wouldn't really be necessary to bring it into all of their daily life all the time.
The next two questions are directed to the teacher. And so I want to know, how much of what teacher says do we take to heart? You know, it's that dreaded first meeting of having to sit in the little chair because they're now going to give you feedback on how your child is doing. Do we believe everything they say? Because, you know, I enjoy some teachers more than others, and I have enjoyed some feedback more than others. How much of it do we listen to? And what if it sounds completely unrealistic or unbelievable? My child would never be that unstable. And emotionally, she definitely regulates herself better. She doesn't have these outbursts, you know. How much of teachers' feedback do we take to heart and in consideration?
Well, coming from a teacher's perspective, I never lie. I'd like to believe that most teachers don't. So when we are giving feedback, it should be constructive. If it's not constructive, then we are not being professional in what we are currently doing. But I think sometimes it can be so shocking to hear what the teacher has to say. But because the child is in a completely different environment at school than what they are at home, and you need to keep into consideration that they are competing for the teacher's attention because there are 35 of them. At home, there might only be two other siblings, for example, where they don't have to compete so much, where maybe emotionally they are struggling to regulate themselves within a bigger group. I do believe as a teacher, though, we should be communicating with parents who we are really concerned about their child continuously. If there is a really great concern, to be continuously once every week or once every 2 weeks saying, look, they had a great week this week, or oh, we had a little incident here, there. Really having that open communication. I know from a teacher's perspective, sometimes talking to parents is just as daunting as parents talking to us. I think we're all sitting there scared in the meetings. But just that open and healthy communication between the teacher and the parent. It's a difficult thing to balance, but it's definitely necessary. If you know, though, I must preface this by saying, if you know your child is really not like that, you really do know your child better than what the teacher does, I wouldn't take everything to heart. When my sister, for example, was in grade R, her teacher said, oh, well, she can't count, she doesn't know her colors. And my mom was like, no, I'm pretty sure she does, because she definitely does. And when my mom went home and asked my sister, why didn't you tell the teacher what the colors were? And she said, oh, I didn't feel like it. So we have a lot of that. So we do try and keep that into consideration as well. Consideration. But you as the parent do know your child. So that instance, my mother knew, my sister knew her colors. She knew how to count. And that day she just didn't feel like it. So us as teachers just kind of also need to take into consideration that as well. But I think certain things you can give and take.
And then I think the question that I really hope you've never had? Because even just having this conversation with you, I feel like the mother of a child in your class. You're a really exceptional teacher, and I really enjoy watching your channel and to see how much effort you put into your lessons and also how you speak about your children. You know, it's really wonderful to speak to you as a teacher. But how do I communicate with my child if they don't like their teacher? I don't want to go to school because I don't like her.
It's a very, very challenging scenario. I mean, we do have children that maybe don't like the teacher. It's not necessarily always the teacher. It could be the school environment itself. It could be that there are certain children in the class that might be bothering them. It's really important there to just make sure exactly why they don't want to go to school. I think it is worth investigating if it is the teacher. And you as a parent have every right to come stand up for your child at school. So you have every right to come to the teacher and say, look, this has really upset my child, or if it's upset you as a parent or whatever it may be, you have every right to go speak to the teacher. And I would like to hear, I know from my perspective, I would like to hear from a parent if I had a child in my class who really doesn't like to come to school. Is I don't think any teacher wants a child to feel that way. I think it's just about how you approach the conversation as well of what has been happening. I mean, I know even throughout my school career, I had teachers who I didn't really like. And then my mother, as the parent, she allowed me to express my feelings, but then also showed me how to kind of cope with them. There were instances where she had to go to school and stand up for me, and that is her job as a parent. So the parents that are listening, that is your job as a parent, and we expect nothing less for you to be involved in a very professional and respectful way. But please come and speak to us. We'd really like to know if something is happening with your child. Let us work together to help the child in that environment. It isn't always easy. You do unfortunately get teachers who are not willing to listen, and that is a very difficult thing to deal with. If it gets really, really bad, I'm sure you could bring in higher management and figure that out somehow between the teacher and the management and the parent. But in most cases, it can be sorted out between parent and teacher.
Do we bring it under the teacher's attention if our children have got anything that we've discovered in educational therapy, or if there's an onset of anything, if they wear a hearing aid, if they have glasses? You know, sometimes we don't see or experience these things all the same. Do we write you a letter, nudge you, write you an email? How do we communicate that to our teacher?
You are always more than welcome to write a letter, come see the teacher, write an email, phone the teacher, however you have access to speak to the teacher. It is very important for us to know, do they have anything that might be influencing their learning, whether it be they have ADHD, autism, whether they have hearing issues, whether they might not be able to see as far. Those are things that we can accommodate within the classroom, or that we really do try to. Unfortunately, children don't often come and tell you that themselves. So us as teachers, we also aren't really trained to notice. I mean, we do eventually notice, okay, I think this child might not be able to see from sitting at the back of the classroom. That might be something then us as a teacher will recommend to the parent. Please take your child for an eye test. There might be an issue. But it's definitely something that we need to keep track of and to keep note of. It is something that I definitely keep note of as well. If they are taking any medications, if they possibly have epilepsy, I know that medication sometimes can make them very sleepy, and that is not the child's fault. So the teacher just needs to be aware of that, keep it in consideration. And we do add that into our planning when we are doing our own planning. We do think of specific children because we would like them to reach the full potential as much as any other quote unquote normal child in the class. All of them should have an opportunity to meet their full potential despite having some circumstances that might hinder them. It shouldn't be circumstances that do hinder them. It might just make learning different, not challenging, not difficult, different.
It's the night before grade one. Tomorrow you're meeting your teacher for the very first time. What do we tell them? And do you, so take me through it. The day before grade one, I'm actually sitting right up to hear this one. So the day before grade one and on the morning, what do we tell them, or do we play it down? Do we create excitement? Do we throw a party? Do we pack cake? I took a balloon to school this year. I was also the only mom with a balloon. So what do we do for first day of school and the day before?
I think the first step for the first day of school is preparing your child maybe a week before with simple things such as a countdown. Oh, it's only 5 more days to school, and create that excitement of we get to wake up early and go learn. I know that it is challenging, and there will be tears. There are children that cry, and there are children that walk in there like they own the place. It's just all the different personalities come out on the first day of school. The night before school, I would recommend talking to your child about school, what they can expect at school, how do they feel about going to school. It's okay to feel nervous. It's okay to feel scared. Mommy isn't going to be there, but I am going to come fetch you. That reassurance of I am coming back is oftentimes what they need, and encourage them, tell them the teacher is there, the teacher is the adult, you can go to the teacher with any problems, if anything happens, if you need to go to the toilet, go to the teacher. Just really explain to them that everything that they are feeling and everything that they are thinking is completely normal, and that they can feel the way that they do. And even for me personally, if there are children that come in crying, you know what? That's normal. I felt like crying this morning too. So that's completely fine. And then us as teachers just take the time to reassure them that they are safe here, and that they, you know, mommy is coming back soon. On the first day of school, what they can expect is that new school smell. I'm not sure if anyone else has ever felt that way before, but there's just the smell that you get on the first day of school, just in the air. But then also you get it. Yeah. You get your own chair at school, and your name is on the table, and like, that's very exciting. And you get to show them that, I'm not sure if all the schools do it like this, but we do it like where they have a chair bag, and this is where you put all your belongings. And that is always very exciting. And on the first day of school, they really will just be orientated to the classroom and to the routine that we are going to start building for the rest of the year as well. So there's a lot of emotions and a lot of singing and dancing, but to build up the excitement and to just be open and honest about whatever you're feeling is probably the best way to go for the first day of school.
There's a teacher at the beginning of this year, she said something valuable, and I never thought of it this way. She said to us in the parent-teacher meeting, she said, I don't believe everything your child says about you to me, so don't believe everything your child says about me to you. And so, you know, there's a lot of the time we walk into schools, and as parents, we're entitled, you know, because we are dropping off our most precious and our precious possessions to you. But I have to ask, as a parent, what can we do for you, Emily, as a teacher? What's the one thing that you wish parents would offer you, or if you were asked, what can we do for you?
I think understanding. There's, because like you say, it's oftentimes only one of your children who are currently in my class. So it isn't your whole family, and those are your most precious possessions. You grew them with your body. Like, that is something incredible, and we do value that. But also understanding that we are working with everybody's precious cargo, and that we are also just trying our best to manage, as well as understanding that we have our own families at home as well who need us. And so we need that understanding of teachers have bad days, and teachers have emotions too, and we aren't always just these happy-go-lucky people, as life happens for us as well. So just that understanding, and with the understanding comes that open communication and healthy communication between the parent and the teacher, to be able to just be on the same page at all times, and not have all of these things swept under the rug, or just trying to let it like float off you, like address issues if there are issues, and if there is something that you would like to praise the teacher for, to thank the teacher for, please do that. It's oftentimes not a very it's a very thankless job, so we don't often get the thanks that we do deserve. So just anything like that, we always welcome as well. It feels so good.
Well, then in this case, we dedicate this entire podcast to every educator and everyone that is helping us raise our children. Because you know what? Your job is so important. Without you, me as a stepmom would never have survived grade one to second year. My one baby's second year varsity. The other one is matric this year. He's doing a fine job. I've got a grade one and I've got a grade three. And because of our teachers, they are thriving. So a big thanks to you as well, Emily Dearham. You can find her incredible. She is one of the best teachers. She is so sweet. At Being the Foundation. Being the Foundation. So you have to go follow her on social media. And Emily, I can't wait to count down to grade one, because tag, you're it. Yeah.
Epimax is proud to introduce a new addition to their range of skincare products. Epimax Tissue Oil is a moisturizing oil recommended to reduce the appearance of scars, stretch marks, and uneven skin tone. This nourishing oil is fragrance-free, colorant-free, and safe to use on sensitive skin. Epimax Tissue Oil is recommended by dermatologists. Try it today and feel the difference. Available at all leading pharmacies countrywide.